Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Raj Rajaratnam, one bad apple convicted of insider trading, while the tree of Wall Street remains unindicted. Where is the anger? Some of the anger got vented in a march on the street yesterday, led by the teachers' union, a couple of Democratic mayoral hopefuls, and the Reverend Al Sharpton.
When they sent the stimulus money in, Wall Street recovered, hedge funds got stimulated. Now they want to lay off teachers and close daycare centers. We're not going to sit by and allow that to happen.
They were protesting what they see as today's version of trickle-down economics. Wall Street messes up the economy and gets bailed out by a Washington tarp, while the pain trickles down to teacher layoffs and daycare closures at the city level. You know, the protest was focused on the Bloomberg budget, but the bigger push was up the money and power chain to Albany, to Washington, to Wall Street's shadow banks.
It might have been more useful if they were up in Albany with our administration protesting the $6 billion in cuts, the effect of all of the cutbacks at state level that really hurt the city.
And a big indictment may yet be coming. There is new speculation about government action against Goldman Sachs, the Wall Street giant that was the subject of some of Rajaratnam's insider dealing. Goldman's stock fell 4% yesterday on the combination of the Raj verdict, two different analysts downgrading the company, and a Matt Taibbi Rolling Stone article laying out a possible case. With us now, journalist and author William Cohan, who used to be a managing director at J.P. Morgan Chase. His latest book is Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. And he had a New York Times op-ed this week called Don't Let Go of the Anger. William Cohan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
And listeners, you be the political analysts on this. We know about your anger. You call us every day. We take you every day. The recent protests have been mostly by public sector employees who might see their pensions reduced or their collective bargaining rights eroded for them personally. Why haven't there been broader protests against the Wall Street firms at the heart of the crisis? That's my question to you today. Why haven't there been broader protests against the Wall Street firms at the heart of the crisis? Our guest, William Cohan, has his ideas on that. We want to know yours. Why have people been so passive? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And, Bill, that was the centerpiece question of your op-ed. But while these calls are coming in on that question, maybe you can explain to everybody this new news about Goldman. Then we'll talk about the anger and passivity of the American people. Goldman Sachs has already paid a $550 million fine last year for misleading clients during the crisis. Now it faces a possible civil fraud complaint from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, we're told. Do you know what that would be about exactly?
Yeah, that has to do, Brian, with the fact that they are a prime broker, which means that they clear trading for various other hedge funds and various other broker-dealers. It is a relatively small part of their larger business, and that is a business that often finds itself into trouble because at various firms because they're constantly working for other broker-dealers and other hedge funds, and sometimes there's trading that doesn't make sense or isn't is not right, and they get pinged for that. And I think that's basically what this little a situation is about there. I think it's, frankly, probably going to turn out to be relatively small potatoes compared to what Senator Levin has done, which I'm sure you were going to get to, in terms of referring to the Justice Department and the SEC potential charges against Goldman based on the hearing from last April.
Right, because there was a Senate report. That's another thing that really should be on that list. Do tell us more about that.
Well, you know, so you mentioned the SEC lawsuit, which was April 2010, and Goldman settled it in June of 2010 for $550 million. Now, that's basically, to me, like a parking ticket for Goldman Sachs. They have $72 billion of capital, of equity capital, so to pay a $550 million fine to the SEC so that lawsuit goes away and is quieted down is worth it to them, and so they did that. Separate from that, on April 27, 2010, people will recall, I'm sure, an all-day hearing that Senator Levin conducted as part of his permanent investigation committee in Washington, where he asked about seven different Goldman executives questions about Goldman's role, not only in related to that SEC lawsuit and the security that they created, but also in the crisis in general, what Goldman's role was. And then it was part of a larger sort of investigation that Senator Levin's committee was doing into the causes of the collapse. And then their report of that committee came out like 2 or 3 weeks ago, and there were about 250 pages of the 650-page report was about Goldman Sachs. And what really got Senator Levin's goat, in addition to everything he describes in there, was the fact that he believes, potentially, that some of the executives who testified in front of him that day, you know, were not telling the truth to him about Goldman's role in the crisis.
So Standard & Poor's last week downgraded Goldman's stock from buy to hold. And yesterday, a prominent analyst named Richard Beauvais downgraded it from neutral to sell. That's all in anticipation of government charges of various kinds?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's probably part of it. I mean, what Senator Levin is suggesting is that, again, from what press reports I've read, he had a press conference where he talked about this. He and Senator Coburn also wrote a letter that has not been disclosed to the SEC and the Justice Department. So it's not exactly clear what he's going after here, although there have been a number of press reports that basically have been, you know, leaking the information, which is that he believes that Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman, and David Vineyard, the CFO of Goldman, perjured themselves in front of his committee. Now, perjury, I'm not a lawyer, but that's a very complex charge to prove. And Lloyd Blankfein himself is a former lawyer and a graduate of Harvard Law School. And so, you know, chances are, you know, making a perjury charge stick in this circumstance, I mean, again, I'm not a lawyer, but it's got to be very difficult to do. Now, that does not take away from the fact that Goldman refuses to admit what they did during this crisis, which was actually, you know, relatively clever as these things go, which was that they perceived early on that the market for mortgage securities was likely to collapse. And by December of 2006, they put together what amounted to what they called a big short, i.e. a huge proprietary bet that the mortgage market would collapse, like very much like John Paulson, the hedge fund manager. Goldman was right. John Paulson was right. Goldman made a lot of money throughout 2007 while the rest of Wall Street was melting down. And now, in the light of day of April 2010, they don't want to talk about it. They want to act as though they were just as dumb as everybody else, which is absolutely ridiculous, because if you look at all the documents that Senator Levin released, which I went through as part of my book, because he released them in April 2010, and I document this very, very carefully throughout the book, you'll see that they absolutely made this proprietary bet against the mortgage market, and they were right. And yet now they don't want to talk about it, and they want to pretend that they didn't do that, which that's what doesn't make sense. That's what I can't figure out. Usually Wall Street firms, you know, crow about their prowess, and normally Goldman would be crowing about their prowess in this particular instance, but they don't want to do it.
And that's at the crux of Taibbi's article, too, in Rolling Stone that's getting a lot of attention. But why is that a crime? I mean, Goldman has mostly come under fire for, I think maybe to take even a step further from what you were just saying, creating mortgage bonds for investors who were bullish on the housing market while making these bets against those bonds themselves. But is that really illegal, or is that just creating products that the market wants because other people thought in their judgment that it was right to still be bullish on the housing market while deciding independently how to invest their own money? Both things are the job of a market-making investment firm.
Well, now, Brian, what you've articulated beautifully Goldman's position on this. which is, hey, we were just giving our clients and our investors risks that they wanted to take. Some wanted to bet against the mortgage market, in which we facilitated that. We decided we wanted to bet against the mortgage market. We're always making bets constantly, one way or the other. Every time one of our clients buys GE stock, we sell it to them. So we're selling. We're making a bet against them in that sense.
Is that wrong?
And the truth is, it's not wrong. You know, whether it is
is it immoral? Is it unethical? Well, is it illegal?
Well, I think Senator Levin would like it to be illegal, and that's what he's hoping that the Justice Department or the SEC can find, that there might be some existing law that might make it illegal. I think where I get bothered, because I think it might, you know, there's some an immorality to the fact that they have made this huge proprietary bet against the mortgage market at the same time where they're hoping that these securities fall in value. At the same time, they're continuing to package up and sell mortgages to their investors and clients around the world at 100 cents on the dollar. So they're betting with their own money that the market is going to fall to like 50 cents on the dollar, while they're continuing to sell these securities to clients and investors around the world at 100 cents on the dollar, knowing that they're going to benefit, Goldman is going to benefit if the price goes down, which it did, and their clients are going to lose if the price falls, which it did. So, I mean, I don't see how you do that. Now, I think it was Fitzgerald who said, you know, the ability to hold two thoughts in your head at the same time is an indication of genius, you know, which clearly this is an ability to hold two thoughts in your head at the same time. But it seems to me when you're making such a huge proprietary bet, you have to say to yourself, you know what? I can't do this to my clients. That's what I would think you would do. Having worked on Wall Street for 17 years, I can't imagine why they would want to, you know, in effect, hurt their clients that way.
William Cohen, former Wall Street executive, author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Now let's get to your Times op-ed, and I'll give you the first word on this. And then, boy, is our board, as you could imagine, full of callers who have their own theories about why the public is so passive with respect to protesting these things. Your op-ed in the Times is called Don't Let Go of the Anger. And you note that the only real protests have been by public sector employees who might see their pensions reduced or their collective bargaining rights eroded, like in Wisconsin. And even yesterday in the March on Wall Street, that's mostly who it was, teachers and others from the public sector, the New York City Comptroller, the Manhattan Borough President, people who want to run for mayor, and are probably looking at a public sector vote. What's wrong with that picture?
What's wrong with it is that well, first of all, you know, if people feel that they want to protest against something like this, I think that that's all fine. That's the American way. Clearly, public sector employees are very good at organizing these things, much better than sort of the general public itself. But, you know, here it's 3 years later. What was done to rescue the top of the pyramid, as you mentioned in the opening, is sort of the ultimate in trickle-down economics. Bail out Wall Street to the tune of $700 billion plus. Some people have put the number in the trillions and hope that once they get back on their feet, it'll trickle down to the rest of us. Well, in fact, it trickled down to them. They got paid $150 billion in compensation last year, but the rest of America, you know, west of the Hudson, everywhere else, is still struggling. You know, high unemployment, high gas prices, all the list of horribles that we know. And so my question was, why hasn't there been more, you know, wholesale protest against this? Because to put Wall Street back on its feet, you know, at the expense of the rest of us, and it's more than just the trillions in dollars that was pumped into the economy. You know, the Fed is, of course, keeping interest rates artificially low. I mean, as low as they've ever been. So as we become a nation of savers again, people who are suddenly worried, and rightly so, that they have enough money for a rainy day to pay for their kids' college education or to pay for gas prices or, heaven forbid, they want a home, you know, the interest that they're getting on their savings is minuscule, is nothing. And that's all being done to help out Wall Street so that Wall Street has access to cheap financing so that it can continue to fund itself, you know, relatively risk-free. And you got to ask yourself, why is that happening and why is nobody up in arms about it? I mean, obviously, I've been writing about it, you know, for more than 2 years, but I just got to the point, earlier this week where I just couldn't figure it out anymore.
All right. Why isn't everybody up in arms about it? Chris and Paramus, why aren't they?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you know, as I think about it, and I think about it constantly, the thing is this. First, I just want to address, why on earth are we going to trust the people on Wall Street to allow wealth to trickle down to the people that they don't even see? We're the people driving economy cars. We're the people living in small houses. We're the people basically bolstering the economy, and they're benefiting from it without... They're not going to allow it to trickle down to us. Why would we, if they can't even take care of their own investors, the people they're supposed to see, the people they're supposed to listen to, why would we trust them to allow it to trickle down to us? And the reason that I'm not out there protesting, the reason that I'm not out there infuriated is because I go to bed at night exhausted from chasing my own tail all day, trying to keep up with the... I was laid off myself. I started a new career in my... Mm-hmm. Infinite wisdom, I decided to become a teacher because I thought that would be a safe option. But now I no longer think that, obviously. And as I complete my teacher training, I'm even more infuriated. But again, I'm working so hard. I've got two children. This was a new career for me. So I think so many of us are working so hard to try to catch up from what mm-hmm. our personal fallout was that
just
I
managing,
think a lot of people are scared.
Managing your own lives. No time to go out in the streets or write a lot of emails to officials or whatever. Shelley in Brooklyn, why do you think people are not protesting more against the bank's lack of accountability?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one word, corporations. They have way too much power in this culture and this economy. Certainly in terms of government and the lack of regulation and real oversight, and also, too, in terms of individuals in the economy. People feel disempowered twice over, first of all, in terms of the corporation power in politics and also in their own personal lives in terms of jobs and resources. And there are no countervailing forces for most workers in this country. It's no coincidence that it was mostly union power out protesting yesterday. That, you know, private workers don't have a countervailing force, either as workers or in their personal lives. And I think people just feel exhausted and beat down.
Thank you. Stephen and Wayne, you're on WNYC. Why aren't more people out protesting?
I think what you have here is basically most of the middle class, some of the upper middle class, the bulk of us out here are hanging on by our fingertips. We're working twice as hard for less. And quite frankly, we just don't have the time to go out there and try to do something about it. We're boxed in. We're just trying to survive.
Thank you very much. And Phil in Queens with a different take. You're on WNYC. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay,
listen,
thank you.
I think most people don't buy the underlying premise of this nonsensical class warfare. People understand that, first of all, with regard to the mortgage, starting with the Carter administration, allowing people to buy houses without down payments and without jobs, and it wasn't Wall Street. Wall Street took advantage of a terrible underlying situation that the Democrats created. In addition to that, people, including teachers, people who are well-educated, again, aren't buying into this class warfare nonsense. They own pensions, they own stocks, they know how to invest, and they realize that it's not only the corporations, it's not only a war on Wall Street, you know, it's not only Goldman Sachs, and that many of them have made lots of money and have done very well.
And I'm going to leave it there. Your point is very clear. So, William Cohan, and we do still have a guest in this segment. Thank you for your patience, as we heard a number of voices there. Former J.P. Morgan Chase Managing Director, now the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. What do you have to say about any of those calls? And to the last one, Phil in Queens, his point that, you know, to put it a little differently, it was really so complex that if people were out protesting, they'd have to protest not just the Wall Street banks, but their next door neighbor's, unaffordable mortgage, maybe their own unaffordable mortgage, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and other government policies.
You know, the caller is right about that. This is an incredibly was a complex web, almost a perfect storm of various aspects that came together. That he's right when he says that Wall Street took advantage of it, because they absolutely did. And you know, that's what, frankly, Wall Street's business is, to take advantage of market opportunities, and they do it all the time. And most of the time it doesn't rise to crisis level, but in this particular case, you know, it did. I also agree with the other three callers where, you know, this whole notion of, you know, just getting by and, you know, daily life intruding, you know, making it very, very difficult when it doesn't affect you directly, personally, when you don't feel, I mean, the truth is, we're all feeling the effects because, you know, this lower interest rates that I described that are, you know, crushing everybody's savings, you know, the inability to now get a mortgage to buy a new home, a higher commodity prices left and right, which we see all the time at the gas pumps and we'll probably see in the food chain. I mean, all of that is a result of this very, very shaky economy that has been, you know, created. I think I wrote in the Times a couple of years ago that this was when they decided to bail out the banks and put the banks back on their feet as opposed to revamping the entire system. Basically, the Fed and the Treasury and Congress put a morphine drip in all of our arms. And now what you're beginning to see, there was that very interesting article in the Times a couple of days ago about Fannie and Freddie no longer packaging up the jumbo loans and how that's going to ripple through the mm-hmm. higher end of the mortgage market.
Right.
The morphine drip is beginning to come out of
right.
everybody's arms.
But I think that's part of the complexity, too. People may be angry at Fannie and Freddie for how they bungled their end, but they also don't want the stable 30-year fixed mortgage to go away, and they don't want it to go away for them if they're sort of at the edge of being able to afford a house. And listen to how this banker was actually shouting back at some of the protesters yesterday.
We need to restore Wall Street! We got to restore Wall Street and give jobs and work. We need to rebuild America by restoring the credibility of Wall Street.
Yes,
it's Wall Street that built this country.
So, William, does venting anger at Wall Street, does bringing charges against Goldman Sachs do anything for the suffering of the American people, or does it actually hurt us in the long run? If Goldman stock goes down, for example, if Wall Street gets socked in general, that translates to even less tax revenues for the city of New York, which means an even worse Bloomberg budget for teachers and kids and seniors and everyone else. Are anger and accountability the way you want to see them perhaps cutting off our nose to spite our face?
Well, again, it's a very complex web, isn't it? There's no question that part of the $150 billion in compensation that Wall Street got paid last year trickles down to the Bloomberg administration, to the city, to the state, in the form of taxes. It also, you know, trickles around in the form of, you know, goods and services that people buy. But that banker who protested yesterday, what he said one thing that was absolutely correct. We have to restore the credibility of Wall Street. And part of what, you know, is going on here is that Wall Street's credibility has been so badly damaged as a result of this crisis. And, for instance, in the case of Goldman Sachs, for them to not come clean about the role that they played during this crisis, you know, I don't think it's illegal, but why they're hiding behind the fact that they were smarter than everybody else and saw the crisis coming and did something about it, why they won't admit that, why they chose instead to, shall we say, obfuscate in front of Senator Levin's committee, you know, damages their credibility. And if Goldman Sachs, which is at the top of the Wall Street food chain, does not have credibility with you know, their clients, with governments around the world, with investors, they're not really a Main Street firm. So if they don't have credibility with Main Street, that may not be the worst thing in the world. But for the leading engine of Wall Street to lack credibility with most people is not good for any of us.
One other thing on the city budget before you go. The May 12th coalition protests in New York yesterday were specifically aimed at the mayor's budget, as we heard before.
Right.
He says, blame Albany. Their cuts are causing our cuts. But he didn't say, blame Wall Street. Listen.
The city doesn't subsidize Wall Street firms. I don't know what kind of subsidies you would think there are. It's not our business, and we don't subsidize any industries.
Now, we're going to do a separate on that on our politics website. So, folks, actually, we're working on it right now. That clip really caught our ear. And we're going to dig into this. And by later this afternoon, we're going to have a piece up on itsafreecountry.org that will seek to explain if and how the city of New York actually does subsidize Wall Street banks. Do you think they do?
Well, I haven't studied it fully, but anecdotally, I certainly am aware of tax breaks, you know, for remaining in the city. All of those tax breaks that Goldman Sachs gets for building its new headquarters at 200 West Street instead of going to New Jersey, or Morgan Stanley for staying in Times Square as opposed to going to New Jersey. It seems to me, and again, I have not studied this, but I'm pretty sure there are tax breaks, whether it's in the form of, you know, lower cost bonds to finance these buildings because they're somehow subsidized by the city or the state. There are definitely tax deals that are cut for right. these companies.
And do you think they're wrong? We had Kim Guadagno, the lieutenant governor of New Jersey, on earlier in the week, and she talked very specifically about how New Jersey is trying to poach some companies from New York.
Yeah, and as they should. In fact, I think probably one of the things that will end up hurting New Jersey in the long run is Chris Christie's decision not to go ahead with this tunnel under the Hudson, because that just, you know, hurts the flow of traffic back and forth. And one of New Jersey's best assets is the ability for people to move back and forth to work in New York. And to not facilitate that probably is going to hurt them in the long run.
All right. Well, we'll talk to former New Jersey Governor Richard Cody about that and more later in the show. But journalist and author William Cohan, former managing director at J.P. Morgan Chase, author of the book Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and a related New York Times op-ed this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.